I want to just ask one question before I start. Originally, when I was asked to do this presentation, it was presented to me to talk about when children become more religious than parents. But the topic sounds religious differences. Are people interested in both sides, one side?
Yes. The other way.
The other way, kids are less religious.
Yes.
Oh, okay, I'm much more at home with that. That's fine. Okay, then we'll... Okay, so now I'm going to then forget everything that's in this summary. Huh? Yeah, the opposite. Okay, maybe some of it will overlap. So I'm totally unprepared because I prepared the opposite. We'll talk about it. We'll see how it goes. Okay. Okay, yeah.
Could you put in just a few minutes on the other
side? I'd love to because that's what I prepared. Okay. All right. So let's talk about, in general, I'll put the emphasis on the kids who rebel. The kids become less religious, okay? And that's certainly something that I've done a lot of work on. I'll tell you a little personal anecdote. Some of you may know that I started an organization in the Five Towns called Kahal, which is a partnership of all the local yeshivas that run special ed. Now you have here in Brooklyn, Ichor HaYeshivas, which was an outgrowth of Kahal. When we were first putting Kahal together in like the mid-90s, I used to have meetings with all the principals from local schools in my office. And I used to call them that this was Mida Kenegan Mida, this was poetic justice. Because as a kid, I was always being sent to the principal's office. And my dream was someday I'd have an office, and I'd make the principal come to my office, and I had all the principals in my office. So this is a subject that hits home. Okay? What I'm going to really do is try to focus on some of the situations or some of the things that we have seen over the years that cause kids to rebel or cause kids to go off the derech. I will try to spend some time on the opposite extreme. And then when we can understand or identify some of the causative factors, then we'll talk about what to do. First of all, let me start by telling you that we traditionally in psychology, we have been parent abusers. We have very often, especially mothers, and this is part of the psychoanalytic tradition, a lot of what Freud has sort of left us, but when something goes wrong with children, we very quickly point accusatory fingers to the parents and particularly the mother. And this has been very damaging. In fact, I would venture to say that in many respects it has done more harm than good. It's not to say that we as parents aren't important. It's not to say that we don't sometimes make mistakes. And sometimes it could be that parents are a major causative factor why children will have problems, difficulties, why children will rebel against religion. However, in today's world, very often parents are not such primary players, and in fact, the damage is done later when parents feel guilty or are made to feel guilty from the community at large. There are many families, and I see this all the time, so I get many of these referrals. There are many families, I'll get referrals from Haredi families that have 10, 13 children, and 12 of them, excuse me? That's fine. That's no problem. You want me to leave to make more room? No, okay, sure. All right, well, let's put it here. Put it over here. Let's put it back here. Not like that. Okay. Okay. Here's the nose ring. And they'll say, I parented him the same. So we have to be very careful, and I have to say this to the community at large, we have to be very careful when something like this happens, not to start looking, scrutinizing what the parents did wrong. It happens sometimes, it's the exception, not the rule. If anything, quite the contrary. Parents who have a child who is rebelling, or is leaving the religion in some way, or less religious, or somehow like something like that, is suffering. In fact, I have to tell you, there's a silver lining in everything you do. One of the beautiful words I once heard was about Yosef. Some of you know the famous, the rabbis say that when Yosef was sent down to Egypt, it says in the Torah that the Ishmaelim that were taking him had these beautiful spices. They say usually they carried tar, which smelled bad, but for Yosef, they had these beautiful spices. So you think, this poor, poor guy, he was, betrayed by his brothers. He's going to be sold to slavery. You think he's sitting there smelling, rosemary. But sometimes you have to smell out the good, even in bad situations. One of the things that I'm perpetually moved by when I work with families with kids who rebel is how upset they are. Because if you think about it for a second, the kid's okay, he's healthy, he's going out, so he's smoking a little pot, and he's long hair, and he does, he's Mechal Shabbos, but he's okay, why should you get so upset? But it shows how important all this is to us, that the parents are so upset. So we really have to be supportive of parents going through this nisayon, not look and point accusatory fingers. Okay. So that one of the causes and one of the situations. Well, let me actually speak in the generality. If I were, please excuse me if I'm a little jumping all over the place, because there was a little misunderstanding in terms of what I'm speaking about. If there is a, if I can say in a general terms, if there is a situation that causes a kid to rebel or to leave religion or to rebel against it, it's if they feel ostracized, if they feel michutz lamachane. That's almost, if again, to extent that you can generalize, that's often, if we take all the so-called risk factors, they all seem to point in that direction. They somehow or another don't feel they belong. They somehow or another don't feel like part of the kahila. I don't know if there are any Balei Tshuva here, but one of the things that I have seen over the years when I sometimes ask Balei Tshuva, like what it was that motivated him to do something so foolish, you know, and et cetera. And very often, again, not always, but one of the themes that comes up again and again is you're part of something. You're part of a group. You're part of a kahila. You're part of a tradition. And people out there in the world feel very isolated. They feel very lost. And if you belong to part of a group, in fact, I often mention this, and those of you who heard it already, please excuse me, I'll make it very quick, but about 5 years ago, psychologists woke up and said, for years we're studying depression, we're studying why people are sad. Let's figure out why people are happy. In fact, in the last group, I also mentioned a study on happiness. But they went out and they studied happiness. But they couldn't just call it happiness, because that didn't sound scientific, so they called it subjective well-being. Happiness, okay? And tried to figure out what it was that, it's very interesting, I have a new diagnosis, you know, I always make, there's something called cell phone narcissism. Everybody thinks it's their own, you know, it's very interesting. But anyway, what makes people happy? And they did a huge international study, it's like 15,000 subjects, and they came up with the three Fs. Okay, anybody want to guess what the three Fs are? Anybody? Family, right?
Friends,
food, only the Jews. fun, no. Not finances. Money had nothing to do except extreme forms. Yeah? Food, we said it's only the Jews, yeah? Faith. That's right. Friends, family, faith. If you have good friends, you have close family connections, you belong to a synagogue, a lahavdil, a church, or a mosque, you are a happy person. And what's the tzad shava b'neim? What do they all have in common? You're connected. You belong. You're part of something. The kids that rebel very often, the kids that reject the religion, feel somehow or another apart. They don't feel like they're part of the group. And there's a very interesting thing about these kids. And I remember once one of my colleagues was standing in line in one of the 42 kosher pizza shops that we have in my neighborhood. And my kids can't believe that I didn't have kosher pizza until I was 10 years old. They think I'm like a Neanderthal man. One of my kids told me just 2 days ago, they thought when I was a kid the whole world was black and white, because all the pictures are black and white. And suddenly when I was 10, there was color. You know, she was standing in line one of those kosher pizza shops, and there were a bunch of kids sitting there smoking and listening to loud music and wearing crazy clothing. And someone in line said, "This is disgraceful. They shouldn't be here." She said, "Yeah, but they're not in Domino's. They're not in Pizza Hut." And it's a very interesting thing. The kids hang out in our pizza shops in our neighborhoods. And it sort of says it. They're saying, "I want to be part of it." Huh?
Yeah.
Well,
they're from your neighborhood.
Yeah, right, whatever. But there are plenty of places they could go. But they want, there is that mixed relationship. They want to be part of it, but they feel apart. What are some of those things that cause it? And again, this speaks to prevention, not what we can do at this point. Learning disabilities. And again, to the credit, Brooklyn now has a program. But kids, if you don't, we forget that school is their life, especially in our community. They're there from 9 in the morning to 9 at night. If you don't fit into that setting, if somehow or another you feel different, then you feel apart. And then you're going to look for another setting where you feel like you belong. If they're family stressors, if it's adoption, if there's financial pressures, if there's parental conflict, if there's divorce, if there's any of those things that make you different from everybody else, that doesn't make you feel like you're part of the group, that is going to be a surefire sign that there's something wrong, or that there's a much greater chance that there will be a rebellion. Now, when we talk about all these different kind of risk factors, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, it's one thing you have to understand in terms of risk factors. Let's say you have 10 risk factors for something. If you have one, there's a 10% chance. If you have two, it doesn't go to 20, it becomes 40. In other words, you have two risk factors. In other words, it grows exponentially. If there is a child that's somehow another part of physical deformity, if there's a stressor in the family, I mentioned in the previous session a very interesting risk factor, which is having an exceptional parent or an exceptional sibling, where you're constantly being compared. I once had a person's son who I saw, if I mentioned his last name, the eyebrows would go up. And I remember he said to me, he had to pick a high school. He said, is there a high school in New Zealand that's never heard of my father? And I said, probably not, you know. But that's also, because then you constantly have to live up to such a, and if you're not going to live up to that image, well, I'll show you. And it's, again, it's not uncommon sometimes in families where there are very famous or exceptional people that want some of the children, one or two of the children will rebel. I remember once I had a kid whose brother, immediately older brother, was like the superstar of the school. And he told me that every year when they heard his last name, they'd move him to the front of the class. And his goal was by Hanukkah to be in the back of the class. And he did very well for himself. So it's very important, and it becomes important, especially if there's a child with these difficulties, to try to find them a place to let them have a sense of belonging, of being part of the group. Now there's one other, and I don't want to belabor this because it's often very shocking, and I will mention it because we have to know it. But you know, I don't want to like. I'm not doing it in any way to sort of distress people. But we had a. Some of you may know that I was edited a manual called Children in Crisis through Nefesh. We got together. It was we formed a conference. I often say it was a very un-Jewish conference because it was free of charge and no speeches. But we got together about 100 mental health professionals, educators, etc. Broke them up into groups and told them to write a chapter in this manual. And the group that was working on risk factors. Came, the way they did it was they had like orange, you know, the orange flags. And it was one of these risk factors, learning disability, family stresses, financial issues, exceptional parent. These are orange flags. If you have two of them, then it can become, I think they had a yellow flag, two are an orange flag, three become a red flag. There was one issue that became an immediate orange flag, and it's sexual molestation. And it is extremely powerful and disproportionately common among kids, which we're seeing later on are rebelling, etc., and happens with much greater frequency than we care to think or want to believe. Again, I don't want everybody coming home now and panicking and giving their kids like these frantic good touch, bad touch speeches, but we have to be aware that this is happening. And as I said, this is often a shocking statistic, but many of you may know that Ohel has a pedophile program unfortunately, I have to say, mostly mechanchim. And I remember about 2 years ago, I was speaking to the director, and at that time, there were 26 in the program, and they had to list the boys. These were ones who molested boys, whom boys they molested, and between the 26 of them, there were 1,500 names listed. Now, and that's not uncommon. It's an interesting thing with molestation is that 90% of the molestation is done by 10% of the molesters. So 90% of the molesters are relatives, neighbors, do it once, twice, feel horrible, don't do it again, but there's that 10% that are compulsive molesters. And when we send our kids to camp, we've got to give them the good touch, bad touch speech. We have to remind children that such things happen. And I'm going to tell you one more thing. And again, I don't want to belabor this point, but there is something I'm seeing since, I would say, last June, with escalating frequency in my practice now, which is what's called in the field juvenile sex offenders, which is children sexually assaulting other children. It was in the general community. It's starting to creep into our community, where I'm talking about where it's not necessarily a teacher or an adult, but it's one child sexually assaulting another child. Huh? I've seen it in adolescence. I've seen it with younger children. I would say the range that I saw were 9 to 15. And I'm afraid this is happening with greater frequency. And again, it's something that we have to learn our children. But those are that there's some. I can't even understand it fully myself. But there's something about that lingers and that festers. And I know that I've dealt with adults who've had these experiences as children. And when they talk about it like it was yesterday. So this is very profound and it's very important. And again, it is a significant factor in kids rebelling. Again. That is not even necessarily just feeling michus amachane, but it's the anger and betrayal. Again, often, especially if the molester was someone from the community, it's just such a stira, it's such a contradiction to what's supposed to be. Let me talk now about the kids. I don't want to spend too much. Well, the kids, when they're there, what do we do? How do we interact? How do we deal with them? First of all, I want to tell you about what I believe to be the two most common mistakes that I see among kids, the teens, and that may be something that we can address. Number one, I think that kids confuse fun and happiness. Let me tell you what I mean. I'll give you an example. Once I had a kid from a somewhat Hasidic home, etc. But he had payas, the family, people who were dressed, you know, dressed in white shirt, dark pants, etc. He rebelled, and the family was very flexible. They let him cut his payas. They let him dress in more modern dress. They had, you know, they bent as much as they could. They had two rules. They wanted no parties, no concerts. So, of course, sure enough, one Friday night, he climbs out of his window. He meets his buddies in the train. They go to a I'll Poke Your Eye Out concert or something like that, you know, with mosh pits and everything like that. And, of course, as these kids invariably do, left the stub of his ticket on his dresser so his mother could find out the next day. We had a family session. And, you know, the parents their hearts were broken. I mean, they were destroyed. So we've been so much. This is the only thing. Why did you have to go? And he said something that I remember really sort of rang in my head. He said, I guess I picked fun over my parents. And I think this is a mistake that a lot of kids are making today. They think that fun, the thrill, is important. And they think that's going to lead to happiness. And as I mentioned, and I already alluded to that study, real happiness occurs in relationships. There's much more happiness to be found in his relationship with his parents than in this concert. But again, the kids, and this is a common mistake that I see among the kids, and by the way, a similar thing, and it's not necessarily the topic here, but I think it needs to be spoken about, and we'll try to speak about it discreetly. There's a similar thing in terms of children's understanding about sexuality, and a lot of problems have to do with boy-girls, and again, that's an area where we're very much at odds with society at large. The kids today are very focused, and I'll say it discreetly, but very focused on the physical aspects of sexuality. They have a very limited understanding that the purpose and function of this part of our lives is to strengthen and cement relationships. And I often say jokingly, it's the opposite of when I was a kid. When I was a kid, we knew everything about romance. We didn't quite know what happened physically, and when we found out, we were so disgusted, and we knew for sure our parents didn't do it. But you know, it was. But today, the kids know every detail, every possible, and unfortunately, many aberrant types of expressions, etc. They're completely unaware, and I've dealt with some very savvy children. They're very unaware that this is part of a relationship, that this really there's the purpose of it, the function of it, besides procreation, is to increase. I can't be interrupted. Okay, so you can save questions to the end. Okay, if the purpose of it is to enhance a relationship, and that's something that I think we need to alter and correct in terms of our education and what we convey to the children, because those two points. Now, the other mistake that kids make a lot, and that's important for us to remedy and correct, is they think you can start something and they can stop it. They don't have an understanding that certain things in life, especially those that are addictive and extremely pleasurable, take on a life of their own. And what I mean is kids who say, I can just smoke pot, I won't take it any further. Or I can just make out with my boyfriend, it won't go any further. And what they don't understand is that things, as I said, there's a reason why in our tradition we have so many safeguards. We have so much to prevent escalation of this sort, because things like this take on a life of their own. After a while, you're bored, you want to take it to the next step. Many of the kids don't understand that, and that's, again, a lesson that we have to try to convey and impart to the kids. Okay, how do we deal with it? How do we address it? Let me talk about a few points. First of all, we have to do everything possible to become more all-inclusive, and that's a community-wide issue. I mentioned learning disabilities. We have to understand we have become such one-size-fits-all people. There's a rabbi in my community that has 5 disabled children. He has a great line. He says, the hand has 5 fingers. If they all be the same, it would be useless. We need different kind of people. There's nothing wrong if we have people. You should know, for example, in our neighborhood, we have, and I'm going to mention it hesitatingly because I don't want it to be deluged, but Rabbi Bender from Darche Torah has a vocational section of his high school. It's only for his kids. Don't come running to his door, but he has a vocational program. I have a taina with him. I often, and we sometimes kibitz about this. Well, he sent me an 8th grader many years ago who was learning disabled, and he was depressed and he was frustrated. I could have had him on the couch for years. I could have made him mint. I could have covered my kid's tuition. It would have been a machaya. In 9th grade, he put him in the vocational program. He started apprenticing with a firm appliance repairman. He was a bria chadasha. He was a new kid. He suddenly had skills. He was effective. He could do something. He's still doing this, by the way, to this day. And I told Raibenda he owes me about 3 years' worth of therapy because I could have this kid in the kid. I didn't need the therapy anymore. We have to be more inclusive. It's okay. We need a broader community. And by the way, I have to say the Hasidic community has us over a barrel as far as that goes. It's far more acceptable in the Hasidic community to do manual labor, to have different kinds of roles and functions. Not everybody's cut out for Lakewood. Not everybody's cut out for Harvard Law School. And we have to become more inclusive so people can feel part of it. We have to be flexible. And the schools, and we have to put pressure on the schools to be flexible. Now, there's a very delicate issue here, and that's the issue of a rodeh from Machdis Arabim, kids who will embrace, who will get other children to do negative, engage in negative behaviors. And this is beyond what I can address. But as much as possible, we should try to encourage schools to be flexible. Not everybody has to sit in school till 9 o'clock at night. Not everybody's cut out for hours and hours of learning Gemara, or maybe later on they will. But we so sour them that by the time they're ready to, by the time they may be old enough to at least do some learning, they've already been so totally turned off. We try very hard to have flexibility. To the schools should have flexibility. Different kind of programs. Not everybody has to have the full load. We have to have placements for the kids. We're having a big problem. There are many more children, and it's not getting any less. There are many more children out there than there are places in high schools. And we have a growing problem in terms of placing children. We had something going on in our neighborhood. It fell apart, I'll admit it. But we had for several years, where at this time of year, we got every elementary school principal and every high school principal together, and we made sure that every kid had a high school placement. There was a lot of bartering and trading. You take this kid, I take a future draft pick. We're back and forth. And some kids fit in better. I mean, if a kid maybe from a more right-wing yeshiva who was rebelling but not all the way yet might fit in better in some of the more modern Hebrew day schools. A kid in the modern Hebrew day school who's getting turned on, who's becoming more firm, but is not that skilled in English, may do better in the yeshiva where the English is de-emphasized. And sometimes a kid needed to be out of town, and the principals collectively had much more clout in terms of finding an out-of-town placement than one principal can. We nearly need, and again, if you want to feel ostracized and you want to feel, get rejection letters from every high school. Be at this time of year when all your friends have a high school placement and you don't. It can't be a bigger rejection. As I said earlier, we have to be supportive of the parents and the kids too. We have to, as much as possible, embrace the kids now, not to the detriment of other children. And there are limits, and sometimes you have to say you can't be among the other children if you're going to have a negative influence. It's a very delicate sign. You have to draw the line somewhere. But as much as possible, if a kid does start looking different, the kid does start acting different, try to avoid the ostracism. If it's a matter of playing with your children and including your children, depends on your child. If your child is, for whatever reason, a vulnerable child, maybe you don't have the luxury of inviting a kid like that over because he may have an influence on a child. If your child is a strong kid, your child is well embedded, successful, etc., you're not going to be negatively influenced by the other child, and you can allow them to interact and somehow try to embrace them and include them. The parents, too. The parents have to, again, here's a point where you may need some direction from Rabbanim. I'm not going to tell you what to do or not to do. I've heard some interesting decisions with regard to that, but sometimes what you tolerate in the home, don't tolerate in the home as much as possible when it's not to the detriment of the other children, when it's not to the detriment of the general home. I remember one principal used to say to me about a kid, if there was a kid, a kid was misbehaving, was upsetting his apple cart, as he put it, so I'm not going to sacrifice Am Yisrael for Reb Yisrael. But if you can, the parents have to maintain the contact, maintain the relationship. That's what it all comes to. It comes to, do I belong? Do I fit in? It happens to be also, to some extent, it is a waiting game. Because as you get older, and this is the age-old problem, as you get older, the world becomes a much bigger place. While you're in school, that's it. That's the only place to go is school. And school, all the schools all over the world are the same. You have desks, you have somebody up there talking about something that's not terribly relevant to you. And some kids can handle it and others that can't. Once you get older, even if you talk about college, suddenly you can take courses that you're interested in. You don't have to attend every class as long as you can get by. And if you don't want college, you can work. I want you to know, there's a lot of talk about ADD, right? Attention deficit disorder, distractible, hyper kind of people. In my neighborhood, and again, it's an opulent neighborhood, we have a bunch of parents, a bunch of adults, and I know this because I'm treating their children, who are ADD up to the gazoo, and it works well for them. because they're on the stock market, they're in the business world, and they're on the phone with 16 different people, and they're running around, and they're making six orders at one time. The other thing, by the way, they all have, you know what all these guys have? They have secretaries. Obsessive, compulsive, organized secretaries who remind them to change their socks, who give them the flowers when it's the wife's anniversary. You know, if I could get these ADD kids secretaries, they'd all do great in school. But, you know, so that suddenly the world becomes a bigger place and there are more opportunities. And to some extent, it is a waiting game. Be very careful with sending your problems to Israel also, because sometimes it works. Sometimes it can boomerang. It has something you have to study, you have to look into, and please have to be honest with the people that you're sending to Israel in terms, because I don't tell you in terms of what happened recently, the consequences can be catastrophic. Let me spend 5-10 minutes on the opposite, in terms of the kids forming out, all right, and then we'll have some time for a little give and take, okay?
What happened
in Israel? Oh, in Israel there was recently in one of these schools there were a bunch of children who were arrested for for pushing drugs, and it looks like they're going to be doing jail time. And that is a kid who overdosed. The kid who overdosed, right? I'm sorry, I forgot about that. The kid who overdosed. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Okay. Two kids. You're right. now, in terms of kids going to the other extreme, first of all, to some extent, and this may apply even to, let's say, moderate rebellion as well. All children have a need to be distinct. All children, all adults. I mean, we talked about this in the last group. Everybody has a need. It's a natural, inbred need to be unique. We cannot, you don't want to be like everybody else, and in fact, it's experienced as a torturous experience to be treated and made to appear and act and look like everyone else. We all have a need, to some extent, to be unique. There are certain people that have it to an extreme. Some of you may have heard of ODD, oppositional defiant disorder. Those are, we call it disorder, but those are kids or adults who have this, like, almost crazed need to be distinct and unique. Sometimes they're very creative people. Oppositional defiant disorder, ODD, it's called. But we all have that need. A very convenient area for someone to assert their individuality is through religion, especially in our community where religion is such a dominant part of our lives. So some of the alternatives, let's say, some of the people who may engage, who may either become more religious, less religious, etc., to some extent, it's the natural, normal need to assert individuality. It comes to an extreme in adolescence. Adolescence is the age where people forge an identity, so you're going to see this all the more so. And if it's within moderation, and if it's kind of natural, and if it is an assertion of their individuality, the worst thing you could do is try to stop it, obviously they can't be disrespectful, etc., but to allow it to run its course. This becomes particularly important when kids come back from Israel. They're imbued with this incredible amount of spiritual, it's a wonderful experience. Ultimately, they'll weave it into their regular life. But they often come home very turned on, sometimes even somewhat radicalized. If you let it run its course, more often than not, it sort of becomes more realistic. We also, and again, sometimes some of the kids who do go to the other extreme, sometimes it is a reflection of inconsistencies they see in the community, inconsistencies they see among parents. It could be a reason for us to do some some introspection. And by the way, just about everything our children do. Whereas I'm not saying it's all our fault. Well, however, if we see a general pattern among our children, certain types of behaviors, certain tendencies, we have to, like, look inside, because very often children, nobody knows us. I often tell parents that children have radar, like they just read us, you know, they know us so well because we're so important to them, and they will pick up, you know, we can't hide anything from them. They will pick up on nuances, etc., and very often it's a reflection of either some inconsistencies in our parts, or sometimes it may even be certain types of religious yearnings in our part. It's an interesting thing. There is such a concept. It's certainly brought down in among the rabbis that there is such a thing as yearning for religiosity. Some of you may know the famous, I think it's a Rambam, it's Maimonides, the situation where they say about someone who won't give a get, that Makanos Hoshomer Yerotzani, that you beat him until he says, I want to. Well, that's a contradiction if you're beating him. It's not that he wants to. And I think it's Maimonides who says that he really wants to. Everybody wants to do the right thing. People want to be consistent, want to be religious, want to be genuine. Things get in the way. So you're just bringing out something that's really very genuine. And sometimes in many of us, there are wishes, especially with age to achieve higher, more heights of religiosity and observance. A kid will pick up on that and sometimes run with it. There is such a thing, I called in the article, Frumkeit with a vengeance. Sometimes it is pathological. So, and you can tell the difference when the kids become sort of evangelical, when it's more like you have to change, when they're preaching, when they're insisting, when they're strident, when it's excessive. And not only just excessive, but it's one thing if somebody themselves, right, wants to achieve very high standards, keeps it to themselves. Another one, they're trying to force it upon other people. Sometimes when there's excessive need to force on other people, it comes from something crazy or some other kind of need. I'll tell you a very interesting study that was done. It was called When Prophecy Fails. And a group of psychologists from the University of Michigan found out about these religious fanatics who were living on a mountain somewhere in the Rockies who had decided that on a certain, on this date, the world's going to be destroyed and aliens are going to come and rescue them and the rest of the world's going to be destroyed. So they wanted to see what's going to happen when that day comes and this doesn't happen. So they infiltrated the group, and I got a little mishig because there was one point where there were more students in the cult than there were cultists, But they infiltrated the group, and they waited for that long-awaited day. And, of course, what happened was the aliens came. We never saw them. No. What actually happened was when the day came and nothing happened, they decided that the aliens, or these powerful aliens, decided to forgive the world because of their religious observance, and now they must proselytize them and convert everybody else. And whereas before they were this isolated group, they went out there and tried to bring in more adherents, etc. That's what I'm talking about in terms of the kind of excessive, extreme type of religious observance, which has nothing to do with really the religion, but is trying to deal with something more personal. Let me just say very quickly, and then just one a side point, and then we'll have a little give and take. One of the issues that I think causes these very radical changes is, and I maybe it's true in my community, maybe it's not true here, but I'll mention it anyway. One of the things that I've observed that's very interesting is that the Israel experience lives sort of in its own little orbit. Then we're going to go to Israel, I'll flip out. It's been so worked into our psyche that you go to Israel and you become, you get turned on or flip in, whatever the kids call it, that is almost like a laissez-faire attitude until then. Like it has almost worked into our psyche that we kind of take a carefree attitude. We don't really matter much, and we send to Israel and then they go overboard. I think we have to factor in the Israel experience. It becomes so normal and natural. Again, maybe not everywhere, but certainly in certain segments of our communities, it becomes so natural and normal that the kids go to Israel for the year or two or sometimes more, that we have to work it into our thinking. It needs to be talked about with the kids. It needs to be integrated. I think there has to be a more gradual ascent to whatever happens in Israel. The high schools have to maybe try to incorporate what they're doing in Israel, and we have to be in touch with the yeshivas in Israel as well, because they're influencing our children. We just sort of hand them over and just wait till them come back and expect them to come back the way they were. That's sort of unrealistic. If we have ongoing contact, what happens there can be much more in tandem with our beliefs and our outlooks, etc. And then also you may have some less of this antagonism that sometimes results between the parents and the schools where they feel like they're competing for the kid. They can work together on it. Okay, gives us about 10-15 minutes. Questions, rebuttals? Yeah, go ahead.
My daughter's 8 and a half, and she has allergies to soy, and she says she hates Hashem, and she doesn't want to wash her hands for bread at school, and she doesn't want to pray.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If it's an 8-year-old, it has very little to do with Hashem. She may say that. 8-year-olds do not... I'm sure she's very bright, I hope that's not the one chasing around the house. No, that's not, okay, no. Okay, I'm sure she's very bright, but 8-year-olds are not thinking theology. It's just her way of expressing her malcontent with the situation. Don't bring in God. You will get, I should mention to you, and since you brought up with teenagers, the whole concept that Tzadik V'Ra Lo, Rasha V'Tov Lo, or why bad things happen to good people, the sort of the existence of evil in the world and how that coincides with God will become an issue, because at that age they start thinking in abstractions, and at that age they can get very vehement about injustice and principles, etc. You're not going to have the 8-year-old, she's just using it as an excuse to express her malcontent. Yeah.
When you say a high school kid, 10th, 11th grade, who has an issue with the sneeze button, she doesn't want to close them, they tell her every day 6 times a day. Is that OCD?
Could be. Several reasons. It could be the opposite, but if it's ODD, it would probably be other areas as well.
That's the main thing.
The SNEAS issue could be several things. I mean, it could be peer pressure. One of the things you have to be concerned with, and this is something we've seen quite a bit, is, let's say, I'm going to paint the picture, and again, a young girl who, for whatever reason, doesn't fit in again. Learning disability. One of the things, by the way, that I didn't mention is something called social intelligence. There's some people that are just socially savvy. There are other kids who just don't quite connect with. I'm not talking about severe cases like autism and Asperger's, but they're just not good socially. Just like there's some adults that aren't. You know, they're nerds or whatever. You know, they don't connect with other people. That's a very hard thing to deal with. If you have a girl who is not socially adept, not well accepted, not popular, etc., and she becomes pretty, she might find her ticket for popularity, and that's something you have to be very careful about, and you have to be concerned about. Okay. What you can do about it, first of all, you can try to enhance general social skills, and the other thing is for someone like that, again, what I alluded to earlier, you have to know, you can't be negative about it. You have to let her know that attractiveness is a gift from Hashem, like any gift, and what do you do with it? It's not whether you have it or not. It's what you do with it, and putting it in the proper context. I mean, again, I'm not in chinuch, and I'm not here to tell you how to teach sneas. But I think the general feeling, the several feelings that I hear from people in general. First of all, I know that certain rabbis want to make very clear differentiations between what's halacha and what's adopted and accepted in certain communities. It's very important to make the differentiation because sometimes there's a confusion about that, especially if they go to a different community. And the other thing is that SNEAS is not just length, skirt length, and arm length. SNEAS is an attitude, an outlook. It's a beauty in and of itself. And how to convey that. So it's not just don't wear this, don't wear that, it's not just associated with sort of negativism, it's imparted in a positive context. There's a way to teach it and to impart such things. But again, it's very important. The same thing's true, by the way, with the boys in terms of sexuality. You can't, if you make it negative, 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 first of all, it's not the reality of what we believe in, and second of all, you're too much then at odds with the world around us. You have to give it a positive bent, that it's something very special, very important. It has its place. That's important. Yeah, I don't know who was first. Go ahead.
What about kids who rebel against religion as a way of rebelling against the parents to say they want to hurt the parents?
Yeah, but that's often the case. That's what I'm talking about. Very few of these kids have theological issues. Very few of these kids are rebelling. The Gemara talks about Achir, that when he saw someone do Shiluach HaKen and then they died right away, and he couldn't deal with the you have that with Holocaust survivors, you have that sometimes, with people who've lived through horrors, etc. Baruch Hashem, our kids today have pretty good lives, they're not so directly exposed to such horrors. So most of the kids that are rebelling, they're rebelling because of social familial reasons. That's generally the norm. It's not, they may couch it in theological issues. They may, they may come in. I know they'll come in sometimes, and they'll say, what's this God business, and all that stuff. But that's not what we're talking. And the kids who are religious, they have answers to these questions, that's almost invariably what it is. What do you do then?
Well,
then, huh?
Obviously, you need to work on communication with the family and whatever. But in terms of, you have a father who's getting more religious, so the kid turns around and stops wearing the minyan.
Then you let them know that my being more religious has nothing to do with you. You're entitled to, I'm not trying to impose it upon you. I'll respect your beliefs. Listen, I'll tell you a situation that I had. Thank God I don't have rebellious kids. My kids are okay. But I remember I used to say sometimes to my kids that when they daven, I'd hear a sonic boom because it was faster than the speed of sound. And I remember once one of my kids was younger and, I went upstairs and he was putting on his tefillin and then I got myself a cup of coffee and was going down and taking off his tefillin, And I yelled at him, how can you daven so fast? Blah, 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 and I went downstairs and I looked at myself and said, now if you were sitting there, so the next day I happened to be walking by, he was putting on his tefillin and I walked over and said, if you only have 10 minutes to daven, say less but say it right. And you daven long. You have to, finesse it, respect, again, there's some things you can't respect. You can't say, I understand that you held up the bodega at gunpoint, and I know you have difficulties, and it's okay, but, appreciate or respect. I mean, again, it's if they feel part, if they feel they belong. Look, we have in our neighborhood, I should have mentioned this, we have a mentoring program. I mean, I could talk to you an hour about mentoring. We had the Big Brother, Big Sister program. It is, in my wildest imagination when I started it, I never thought it would be as successful as it is. And it's just cool young guys, many of them NCSY type advisors, etc., hanging out with kids, and it turns them around. It's changed the whole complexion of my practice. I mean, it's taken care of some of just those angry, rebellious kids that before I couldn't address. Okay, on the floor over there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And one parent, you know, like they're hanging out with friends that have boyfriends, and they have a boyfriend, and it's really way more prevalent in the community. Our parents, the kids that are high, go to another friend's house, meet their boyfriend, and the parent doesn't know, and the other parent says it's okay because they're going to do it anyway, and the other parent says, no, they can't because it's not meant to be.
You just gave my speech. What am I supposed to say? You know,
I don't know.
That's not a psychiatric. Listen, I remember once one kid I was working with told me that he's driving down to Florida with his girlfriend. They're going to sleep in a hotel overnight. They're not going to do anything. I said, now I'm really worried about you. You know, it's like, you know, something really wrong with you. You know, it's very natural that boys and girls. Or I once had a mother. Frantically call me, her son was seen on Central Avenue hugging a girl, and I don't know, I guess it was in one of my moods, it was late at night, so at least it was a girl. You know, she hasn't called me since, but, I keep my practice not too busy, you know, what could be more natural, and, I mean, I don't have to tell you what's going on out there, and I don't care how much you try to insulate and protect, and you know, it's so, I mean, every poster, every commercial, every advertisement, it's, you can't get away from it. I mean, I thank Kaddish Baruch Hu day that I'm not a teenager today. I don't know how the kids are okay. So it's very natural, and they do find each other, and it's every segment, and you know.
Am I wrong?
You're wrong about what? Yeah, it doesn't. Wait a second. Now let me. Okay, let me be. Okay, no. But let me. Don't go to the other extreme. Also, there's nothing wrong with making it very clear that you disapprove and you think this is bad for them, even if you're not punishing them and controlling them. This is where parents, I should mention this, make a lot of mistakes. Like the typical thing, I say, you know, you tell your kid, I want you home by midnight. The kid's 6'4", captain of the wrestling team. Yeah, what are you going to do? You know? So then other parents feel, all right, I can't control them, so I'm going to let them do whatever they want. That's not true. You're still a parent, and you still know what's good for them, and you know, and I don't have to explain to this crowd how destructive and harmful such activities, though they're very tempting at that point, how destructive and harmful they are in the long run. You state your position. Now, if you can't, you have a daughter who's out there, you know, hanging out with guys, short of tying her to the bedpost, you can't control it, right? That doesn't mean you can't let her know that you think this is something bad for her, this is harmful, and you don't want it to continue. That's perfectly okay. You still have a position. And let me tell you something, it's in there. It stays in there. They hear it. They may not respond to it, or for all you know, I can tell you, I've heard it in my office, that sometimes it stopped them from going a certain step that they would have otherwise, just that disapproval. So don't stop being a parent.
But that doesn't always work.
It may not.
100%.
It may not work, but just because it doesn't work doesn't mean you don't try. That doesn't mean you don't get it. What I'm telling you is that don't get into these endless power struggles. Teens are great at getting into power struggles. Okay. Yeah, what are you going to do? I'm going to call the police. Yeah, then I'm going to call the police on you. And then I'm going to, you know, and then before you know it, and then you're rolling on the floor wrestling, I mean, or something, or you are like trying to keep her home, and you're calling neighbors and keeping away from the boys, and you're calling the boys, or she even, you can't necessarily control it, but you can still have a position, and you can tell them, and that's the bottom line. It's not good for them. That's the bottom line of everything. We discipline kids because it's not good for them, not because of what makes us look good or bad or something like that. Yeah, okay. Huh?
Okay, what?
So you explain it to them. Hope you know. And if you don't know, you better start thinking about it.
But then you end up responding with an answer that has to do with
Yiddishkeit, and with some kids, when you use that...
Right, no kids.
They go the other way.
Right, as soon as they hear it, that's right. Right, as soon as you tell them to say so on the Shulchan Aruch, you've lost them, 100%. But... there's a then you have to come up with a reason that may not have to, or the reason why we have these restrictions, and you have to come and then you have to be clear yourself, and if you're going to just say something that you heard in a speech or something and you don't mean it, they'll rip you apart. So you got to be clear yourself, and I get this question. I deal much more with boys, so
I'm
don't
clear,
get
but I know that sometimes if I say something from and I explain it. And I bring from a firm angle.
So let me ask a question. A Catholic kid, should a Catholic kid be out there like that? Is that good for them?
No.
So why not? No, right? Why not? Think about it from that perspective.
No.
I get asked by the boys, and maybe some of your boys, and the question I get asked all again and again is, I understand God said there's a thing called kashrus. There's food out there. Some you can have, some you can't have. I understand God said that when you're married, you can have pleasure with one person, not others. But I can't understand why God at 14 gave me these incredible desires and said I can't do a thing with them until I'm 24. And if you don't have a good answer for that, you know, and it's a good question.
What's the answer?
I'll give you the answer. I'll tell you the answer that one of my colleagues is. I'll tell you the answer. One of my colleagues says, well, he gives the driver's license example. Like, you know, there's certain things you're not old enough yet to use or to appreciate or to do correctly. Of course, so the question would be, the kid would come back and say, then give me a brand new Lexus and car keys and tell me I can't drive it. I give them the metaphor I use. And it doesn't always work, I want you to know. I mean, it's inadequate, but metaphor I use, I say, you know, someone gives you a diamond, a very special diamond, a beautiful special, a crown jewel, beautiful diamond. He says, you can do one of two things. You can put it away and save it for someone very special, or you can cut up in pieces and give it out to a lot of people. And that's what I try. So, of course, when the wise guy answers, I go, well, can't I cut just like a piece or two for, you know, like, you know. But, I think it's important, especially in today's world. Look, we have to live in the world we live in. I think we have to spin sexuality, heterosexual relationships in a very positive light. But positive light in terms of what it really is and what it really can be. But it's extreme. There's never, you know, look, every year, every generation, we're at odds with our surroundings with different things. My father talked about when he first came to America, the tumult that was going on with Shechita. You know, today, you know, you have glatt kosher bubble gum. You know, it's, today the issue is sexuality and gender issues. And that's where we're at odds with our surroundings. And we have to be prepared and we have to address it and we have to be ready to answer and we have to be also, a sounding board. Our kids have to know that they can come to us, or if not us, that's where the role of rebbeim mentors come in, who can do this. And I know, by the way, and I'm telling you, in the most quote unquote right wing yeshivas today, rebbeim are talking to the boys about it. I hear about it. They're starting to talk to the boys about these things. And the past would have been, the famous joke about Kadaka Shalom Kadaka. Have you all heard it? No. You're learning the story of Dina. And it says there, Vayishkavas Avayaneha, that he slept with her and he tortured her. Rashi says, Vayishkavas Agadarka, ordinary, Vayaneha, torture, Shalokadarka, inordinary, and the Bacha raises his hand, Rebbe, Vushalokadarka, Rebbe goes on the Zetz and says, Kadarka, Vaistu, that's not the world today. Today they're talking, and we have to, because of what's out there. They're exposed no matter what. You know? Yeah, you're anxious to say.
Yes. I'd like to know, in college, Jewish boy, not so firm, meets Gayish girl. First is just studying, they know they're not supposed to, and then it goes on years. They tell the parents already, we know your point of view, I don't want to hear it, and what do you do?
What do you do? I mean, what can you, at that point? You state your position, you make it clear. The only thing you can tell them is that there is research that interfaith marriages aren't as successful as same faith marriages, that there are, you know, you can try to project ahead of time, what are you going to do, Christmas, Hanukkah, I mean, you can try. You can't stop trying. There's nothing right away wrong with good old-fashioned Jewish guilt. You know, the Mel Brooks routine, when he brought Anne Bancroft home to his mother, said, now you two enjoy each other's company, I'm going to be in the kitchen with my head in the oven. You do everything and anything in your power. I have, by the way, I have this a lot, and again, I'm bringing up, I have this a lot with kids with disabilities. You know, the LD, the Jewish boy.
LD,
yeah,
right.
Jewish LD boy, and unfortunately, the given, even outside of the film community, the, you know, the Jewish girls want someone, lawyer, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, and meets a non-Jewish girl, and he knows he's got the cards stacked against him. Sometimes contacting the Hillel director, the Chabad person, you pull out every,
when they're 30 already.
This is a big problem today. I mean, it's not just college. It's law firms. You know, a young guy, he and associate are working on a contract till 3 in the morning together. It's a very big problem. I don't know what to tell you. I really don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know who's been raising their hand the longest. She hasn't raised her hand the longest. Okay.
You have a child. He's a college in the house.
Yeah.
It's obviously not what you want in the house.
Yeah.
What does one do?
Okay. There's not any number. First of all, if you can, first line of attack is to say, I'm not asking you because I need you to be Shomer Shabbos. There are other people. Have respect. Use the old metaphor of, listen, I know when colleagues of mine want to take me out for lunch, then you have to go to a kosher restaurant, you know, because I can't eat in the other ones, you know. So it's not that I'm trying to force it. It's an accommodation. It's consideration for other people. Here you're going to need direction from, I've heard, and I've been in situations too, sometimes you will get permission to allow a certain amount of Chilul Shabbos in the house. That's not b'farhesia. That you have to get, you have to speak to a rabbi. I can't tell you to do that, but you have to talk it out, because each case, and even when the rabbanim give you a psak on this, they'll always come with a warning. But don't publicize it, because every case is different, and every there is such a thing, by the way. And this is not only in terms of Chilul Shabbos, but even in terms of when there's like real conflict between a child and a parent. There have been situations, and this has been done very successfully, where the kid moves out. Maybe we'll move in with a relative, a friend's parents, etc. Where it's not you're thrown out, but, you know, it's just gotten too heated between us. We need to go back to our corners. And you're going to stay with this other person as a stopgate measure. In the meantime, we're going to go for family therapy. We're going to try to work out our differences. The goal is to bring you back home and have you reintegrated. And that has worked, by the way. And sometimes it's far more successful than letting it escalate to the point where there's irreparable damage done. But there's a lot of, you know, there's an issue of, and sometimes the kids are not willing to just, you know, to limit it to their room, or, I mean, you know, or to put an earpiece on the television. You have other siblings. You got to weigh all that. You have to consult. You have to talk to a rabbi. And sometimes it may come to a point, especially if it's detrimental to other people, where the child may have to leave. And again, even then, I'm not throwing you out. It's not working. We have to figure out someplace else where you can be, and we'll work it out. I know it's painful. It's very hard, but that's sometimes better than letting something reach a point where there's such damage and so harmful. Yeah. That's got nothing to do with being Hasidic.
Well,
Hasidic are people bathe. So that's got nothing to do with, there's no such thing as a religion that doesn't believe in bathing.
Uh-huh.
Right.
But if there's a rebellion going on, clearly your limit setting at this point would not
work. Let me just say this without going into specifics. When somebody starts, especially with an adult, I mean, granted, you know, a 9-year-old not bathing, I mean, that's, you have to worry about a 9-year-old who's bathing. I mean, that's a different story. But an adult who's not engaging in self-care and hygiene, you're talking about, you have to really consider there's something probably psychiatric going on. That has nothing to do with religious observance or what group they belong to. Yeah, that's already, lack of self-care has nothing to do with religion. Okay, yeah. He's not stupid, but he doesn't know his limits. You know something? I don't know my limits. You know, it's the old story. You know, the Chafetz Chaim couldn't be alone in a room with an 80-year-old woman. I mean, the point of the matter is, and this we know amply from our rabbis is that there's no self-control of sexuality. There's external control. That's why we have all these rules. That's why we have these limitations. And, we just have to look at the world around us. I mean, look at Bill Clinton. I mean, the president of the United States. My God, Saul Wachtel. Remember Saul Wachtel? Wachtler. Oh, Wachtler. I'm sorry, Wachtler. So Wachtler, chief appellate judge in the state of New York. I mean, there's no such thing. That's the point. You discuss it. You have to explain to him. You have to avoid in situations that, in other words, where you get problematic is when you have to win. That's when it gets, when you get irrational, he gets irrational. You're the parent. He's 17. There's a limited amount of control you have. You impart to him as much as you understand. And if it becomes that kind of power struggle, all he's thinking about is, my mother's hassling me again. If you can avoid it from becoming that, then maybe the validity of what you're saying, even if they don't 100% say it, and even if when you leave, the kid didn't agree with you, it's in there. It really is in there. I can't tell you how many times. I can't tell you how much times in my practice where I'll say something to somebody and like that. And a year later, remember when you said blah, 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 blah. It sinks in. And you know something? It's right. We know that. It's the truth. It's what's really supposed to be. And ultimately, that has a certain power too. You know, it's just like I said earlier with Malcolm Sochum and Rotsani. You know, it's the MS. And that helps, and that somehow or another, and the most, the wildest, most impulsive kid knows it. Can I tell you a great story? I have a wonderful story. I want to tell you a great story. I heard a priority one weekend, and it's a good story to end with. And I heard this from no less a personage than Rav Matisyahu Solomon. He told about, apparently he must have learned in Haifa for a while, and he said there was a guy in Haifa with him who was a chazer b'tshuva, and a real geschmackte guy, learning and everything like that. So he asked him once how he became from. So listen to the story. He said he grew up in a Shomer Tzair kibbutz. He said by the time he was 20, he had satisfied every taiva, every desire you could imagine. And he was, as most people are in those situations, he was bored. He was frustrated. So he heard there's a store in Haifa that satisfies any, this is when Matisyahu Solomon told the story, any desire you want, anything. So he steps up to Haifa, he goes to Hachanat Mechazit, he gets the bus there, he finds where it is across the street, and there's a display window with every paraphernalia video that you could imagine. And he's foaming at the bit, and suddenly he sees in the corner of his eye a Haredi guy with a black hat and a beard walking down the street. And he watches him as he's walking the street, and when he looks and he sees the story, he looks at him, and when he sees what it is, he goes like this and he runs away. And he says to himself, this guy's got a taiva for something stronger than anything in the store. And he goes running after him. Is that a great story? Okay, thank you very much. Okay.